Brought to you by the Small Business Payments Alliance. According to a new survey, an overwhelming majority of small business owners oppose additional government regulations on the electronic payment system, as called for in the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. Don't let Durbin-Marshall pile new mandates on Main Street small businesses. Learn more at smallbusinesspaymentsalliance.com.
Carlos Lozada is a columnist for the New York Times, and before that, the longtime nonfiction book critic for the Washington Post. In 2019, Lozada won the Pulitzer Prize for criticism for a series of pieces that judges described as trenchant and searching reviews and essays that joined warm emotion and careful analysis in examining a broad range of books addressing government and the American experience. Well, he's now collected nearly a decade of such reviews in what he calls The Washington Book, How to Read Politics and Politicians, which was released this week. If the art of politics can be to subtract meaning from language, to produce more and more words that say less and less, he writes, then it is my purpose as a journalist to try to find that meaning and put it back. He reads a lot of books by politicians. As he likes to say, he reads all those books so that you don't have to.
If people want to read my columns and reviews and books in lieu of reading all the others, I have no problem with that. I have no concerns.
But he's found a way to use those books to say something interesting about those same politicians.
What is real? What is performance? With politicians, I think it's a sort of an instinctive reaction to assume that everything at all times is a performance.
So what is Carlos's close reading of the likes of Barack Obama and Donald Trump and Joe Biden, Mike Pence, Ron DeSantis, and many others reveal about our politics in 2024? It turns out quite a lot. I sat down with Carlos in Politico's offices this week to find out. Oh, and stay tuned until the end of the show where we're going to try something new this week. And Carlos takes a question from one of those same politicians he's always trying to decode. I'm Ryan Lizza, and this is Playbook Deep Dive. Let's talk a little bit about being a book critic in Washington at the Washington Post, writing a lot about the books of people you might be rubbing shoulders with here and there. What are the considerations when you're in that business? How did you and how do you see the role of book critic? Just thinking about a book critic in general, because there are different like philosophies behind it.
Yes.
Some people who say, you know, I've heard say, you know, if I'm going to give it a one-star vicious review, I'm not going to review it. Mm-hmm. I only want to, you know, review something that is like, you know, worth my, that I think is quality. How do you view some of those considerations?
Yeah. I don't have a problem with negative reviews, even with harshly negative reviews. They just have to be harsh in a way that's compelling to read about, right?
Yeah.
You know, you can think of book criticism as purely derivative, right? In that it's so heavily reliant on the source material. But I don't see it that way at all. It has to stand on its own, right? Yeah. It has to stand as its own piece of writing, you know, independent of the book that it's engaging with.
Right.
But you know, there's nothing worse than, you know, a critic saying, here's a book you'd never heard of and it sucks.
Yeah.
Right? Like there's a pointlessness to that. So you at least have the good grace to dislike something in a way that is compelling. Like an example of that, for instance, I wrote about a book by Senator Ben Sasse called Them.
Yeah.
The subtitle was something like Why We Hate Each Other and How to Heal.
Yeah. And that's included in this collection.
Yes. That is in the collection. Thank you. I should do the thing where I like pitch the book. You know, like, as I say in the book, right? I always forget that part. And that is one that actually when it came out, I read thinking I was going to write about it. And as rarely happens, I just had nothing to say. I just thought like this book is not interesting enough to dislike publicly. But then when Sasse, you know, years later, he announces he's stepping down from the Senate, he's going to run University of Florida. And I was hearing his rhetoric about that move, and it reminded me of Them, you know, right off the bat. And so I went back.
Reminded you of the book.
Of the book. Yeah. And I looked at my old notes, And I kind of read through it again. And suddenly I had something to say. Suddenly I had a reason to write about it. So to me, that was instructive, right? That sometimes it's not sort of you and the book, but also the moment. You know, there's a moment when a book is more relevant, is more apropos, and not just in a news peg sense. You know, like old books that had real significance in the past can be significant in new ways later on.
I know what you mean about the book. Here's something you never heard of. This is why it sucks. It's like that with profiles of people, especially politicians. If it's someone nobody's ever heard of, it's rarely unless it's some investigative scandal piece where they did something wrong. You know, you're rarely going to, you know, write a piece about some aspiring Senate candidate or something just to completely torch them.
Right. What's the point?
That's the second or third profile, right? Like after they've actually accomplished something. That's a good point. Let's talk about some of the characters and some of the reviews. I'm going to skip around a little bit because there's so much that's interesting to discuss. Let's talk about Biden.
Yeah.
And who's written quite a few books and has had, and even some of the stuff that's not in here, I presume you've read the more recent burst of Biden books about the first couple of years.
Mm-hmm. I've started to. I want to do a big Biden piece where I
combine. All right, we got to preview that.
Where I combine the sort of like, I want to write about his memoirs, and then I want to write about the Biden books.
All right. Well, we're gonna get a little preview of your thinking on this. So let's start with we'll start wherever you want in terms of the Biden books that are out there. What do you learn from these books that you haven't been able to get necessarily elsewhere?
Well, I read "Promise Me, Dad," Biden's memoir about. Basically, his last year or so as vice president, which was also the time that Beau was ill and dying, that Beau Biden was ill and dying.
Yeah.
So I recently read that, and I'm starting to read his first memoir, Promises to Keep. And I also have read recently Evan Osnos's slim book on, but very good book on Biden that was published just before the 2020 election. So that's my universe. I've got the Chris Whipple book and the Franklin Foer book and others that I am sort of like on my list.
Okay.
But something that really struck me in this whole debate about the, you know, Biden's age that we're having now, and that is in the book by Evan Osnos at one point in 2020, leading up to that election. So, you know, Trump, Biden is 4 years younger.
Yeah.
Osnos asks him flat out, you know, so is it, what do you think about when people raise your age as a problem?
Yeah.
And he had an answer that is very apropos of this moment. And he said, I think it's completely legitimate for people to take that into consideration. I would just ask them to do one thing. Look at me.
Yeah.
And then decide.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And look at me, decide feels different in 2020 versus in 2024.
Yeah.
Right? The eye test is tougher on Biden today than it was then. But even then, he was saying that was a completely sort of legitimate way to think about this one issue that gets worse every day because we all grow older every day.
Yeah.
Right.
Now it's the opposite. It's an argument about how what you can't see. The argument is behind the scenes.
Yes.
This guy is incredible, even if he looks like, you know, he's lost a step or more.
That's always
in public.
That's always, that always feels
never
like
a good sign.
That always
like,
feels like the last refuge that, like, oh, in small groups, he's amazing, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, the HER report.
Unfortunately, that's not how campaigns work.
Exactly. Yeah. You got to show me that guy. Yeah.
It's big groups.
But you know, what was interesting to me as well about the, and I almost wish that Biden had said something like this the day of that, you know, unsuccessful press conference, in the aftermath of the special counsel report that had that devastating line that he's a well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory. You know, there was that episode about, did he remember the year that Beau died, right?
Yeah.
And when you read Promise Me, Dad, his book about the year that Beau died, his acknowledgments at the end of the book begins with, I'm going to paraphrase it here, but it begins with a line saying, like, look, this was a very difficult period for me to look back upon. And as a result, some of my memories of this period are foggy. I relied on many people to help me reconstruct, you know, the chronology and the events of this time, right? And that struck me as such a human explanation.
Yeah.
You know, no matter your age, if you've had loved ones who you've lost, especially over a protracted illness, there are things that you block out.
Yeah.
There are things that you do not, that, you know, like I lost an older sister, and my other sister and I, sometimes we talk about the period of her illness, and we have conflicting memories of things. You know, we don't exactly, I have to remember in my head, you know, okay, that was 2009, right? So it's been 12 years. No, it's been 15 years, you know, like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I remember I can't remember if I saw the press conference and then read it, or if I had just read it when I saw the press conference.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just thought like, yes, it's a completely normal thing to not remember was it 2015, 2016? Who cares? You know, like it's not like that. It's not an important thing. And I think that there was a much better way of addressing it in a way that was far more relatable than saying like, than the like, how dare you school of political responses, you know, like how dare you is not, you know, has only been used well once in the, you know, have you no shame, sir, you know, there's no other moment for how dare you. It doesn't play well as a response. And yet Biden, in the acknowledgments of Promise Me Dad, had a very human explanation for, you know, how the mind, you know, will block out traumatic memories.
I have two thoughts about this. The first is about the famous line that you mentioned in the HER report, which you should also review if you haven't already.
I have not.
So I'm sure someone has said this, but it strikes me as both a very obvious thing, but also or a very obvious observation, but also one that I haven't seen out there. And is there a case to be made that HER was actually saying, not that Biden is an old man who can't remember anything, but that he was playing one in the course of the investigation, and that's what he would play in front of a jury, and we can't, we don't have a case if he does that. It reminds me of Rupert Murdoch that time he came before Congress and pretended to be like, you know, 120 years old and couldn't remember anything. Because the and I don't have it in front of me, but the introductory clause to the famous line in the HER report is he would appear
to a jury
yes. something.
Yes.
So that, you know, I don't know that I have a question here, but it is.
I mean, that's
it is one way to read that, and it'll be interesting to see.
Brian Liz and Machiavelli.
They knew what they were doing at the same time, so they wanted to fall back on that excuse, but. It is one way to read all of those criticisms and put them in a new light, where they're just saying, we're not saying he's an old man who can't remember anything.
We're saying he looks like an old man who can't remember anything.
He played one to us, and he'll probably do the same to the jury.
You know, I do want to read the HER report. What I read more recently was the Alabama Supreme Court ruling on IVF. I read Dobbs and written about Dobbs when it came out.
Not to jump around too much, but I really, what was great about your reading of Roe, Casey, and Dobbs is you point out, and you can expand on this for me, the difference in tone over those decades from Roe to Dobbs.
It was remarkable. You know, when Casey, first of all, when the Dobbs case was leaked to Politico, obtained by Politico.
Yeah. I wasn't part of that.
In the proper nomenclature, it was obtained by. I read it right away, but everyone started writing about it. And so I thought, like, normally I would kind of, you know, maybe write something about this, but I was thinking, like, what would be interesting for me to say? Like, I'm not, you know, I don't cover the law or the court.
Yeah.
But as you're reading it, it has so many references to what it thinks of Roe and Casey that I just thought, like, well, I should just go read Roe and Casey, right? Yeah. If I'm going to write like a 3,000-word essay on the evolution in the Supreme Court's, you know, demeanor across Roe, Casey, and Dobbs, I feel pretty safe that not a lot of people are going to be doing that.
Yeah.
And so I gave myself some time to like read through them, and it's just. I mean, you don't have to be a genius to like identify this. It's just so obvious, right? Like in Roe, you see Rehnquist, who was not yet Chief Justice, even though he was in the minority, he was talking about like how much he respected the legal scholarship and historical inquiry of the majority opinion. It commands his respect, right?
Yeah.
Even if he disagreed with, its legal analysis. The brethren all around, right? Everyone loves each other.
Yeah.
Then you get to Casey, and in Casey, you start seeing like much clearer tensions. Scalia on one side, talking about the czarist arrogance of the majority. Yeah. Casey was weird. It was not really a straight up majority. It was like a controlling opinion. And you see them like taking pot shots at each other. But in Dobbs, oh my God, they flat out question each other's motives.
Yeah.
They accuse each other, not even implying, just saying that, you're letting your political convictions override your jurisprudence.
Yeah.
It's brutal. It's like they've lost all, it's like they're like everyone else, right?
That's what really comes through in the book. By that point in your book, you're into the, the politics descending into civil war stuff. And it's like, oh wow, it's even happening in the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And that's something people say. But when you go back and look at those three opinions and analyze them in the way that you do, it really sort of brings it home.
And Joan Biskupic wrote a book about the court recently called Nine Black Robes. And, she says that there's a certain empowering quality to having a six-person majority versus a five-person majority. Hmm. When you're still going in the same direction,
yeah,
but you can go much further. You know how I said there's often just one main insight that I draw from each of these books that I remember? Like that's the main one I remember from Nine Black Robes. That there's something, there's a certain power in numbers that you don't have when you're 5'4". Like if it were 5'4", then John Roberts would be the center of the court, right? Right. He'd be the new
right.
Kennedy,
right.
right? But he's not. He's right. left begging, right?
Right.
And when it's 6'3", you still go in the same direction. You can just go a lot further. And it becomes a battle then of like, how far do we want to go?
Yeah.
Do we want to go like full Clarence Thomas? Do we want to go Gorsuch and Kavanaugh? Where do we want to be?
Yeah. I want to go back to Biden because I have a sort of impolite question about Biden and grief. But do you ever think when you read some of Biden's memoirs and even some of his speeches, do you ever think that he crosses the line into using the tragedies that he suffered in his life for performative, overly political reasons? For instance, the White House's reaction was when the Hurd report came out to really play up "How dare you?" On the Bo stuff.
The only honest answer is that I have no idea, right? If what is real, what is performance with politicians? I think it's a sort of an instinctive reaction. To assume that everything at all times is a performance, and I say this as much just as being from being a citizen and a resident of Washington for all these years and kind of watching him in action is that to me it feels so part of who he is but also who he sees himself as being.
Yeah.
Right. That I think it's sort of utterly instinctual for him now to kind of gravitate towards those, not in a performative sense, but as in the defining moments in his life.
Yeah.
The loss of his wife and daughter, early, and the loss of his son late. It's almost like Beau's death, brought all that back again. That sort of well of grief was replenished.
Yeah.
But I don't see that as being sort of manipulative. I sort of see that as being real. Now, I also, at the same time, it can also be true that, that even if it is completely real and genuine and heartfelt, that people may no longer respond to it in the same way, right? That it may not create that well of sympathy that it once did. But that's a matter for pollsters, not for book critics.
Yeah.
But that's how I would think about that. You know, that Beau's death kind of brought it all back. That's how I think of the Biden story. It feels real to me when I see him do it. But within the trappings of the White House, it's so hard for people not to imagine that everything is performative. And knowing that, maybe cool it a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you were a tough, honest critic, so I would trust your judgment on something like that. That's why I wanted to ask you about it. Let's talk about Trump. Sure. And I mean, you've read them all. The number.
No, it's impossible okay, to read them all.
It brought back the book business, though.
The Trump canon is endless. I think someone did the math, that for the first year, for the first 4 years of the Trump presidency versus the equivalent period in Obama, and Obama was written about a lot, as you know.
Yeah.
That it was like triple the number of books or something. Like, it's just something absurd, something utterly absurd. And
they kept doing well.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's still happening now.
But. Michael Wolff. I blame Michael Wolff for all of that.
Yeah, because he was the first.
Fire and Fury was the first, not the first like Trump book, but the first Trump White House book. And it kind of set a template for how every other journalist, you know, wanted to write about, you know, the crazy anecdotes, the like, could you believe he was doing this?
And a lot of it was true too. In that book.
Yes.
A lot of what Michael's stuff.
A lot of it was even true. There's a book critic's backhanded a compliment, right? I'm sure a lot of this book is even true. Yeah.
I just remember in his last one, he reported as a matter of fact, that Trump actually is bald and that the thing is a toupee, which, and he has an anecdote in there with Trump walking down a staircase in the White House without any hair. And I just remember thinking, is that true? Did Michael, nobody else has ever actually stated that as fact. And Wolf, in his Wolfian way, is just throwing it out there. But anyway, that's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah. There you go.
That's a nice description of the evolution of the books. He did create this appetite. The stories were incredible. What are the highlights from that era? What are the good ones and the bad ones? What are the memorable ones?
I mean, it's funny. The ones that are often most memorable to me are not necessarily the biggest sellers, the ones that did really well.
Yeah.
But I mean, I learned from a lot of them, right?
What did you learn about Trump that you couldn't get elsewhere?
And if, one example of a book that I found very useful to understand the Trump era that I think was not as kind of high profile as Wolf or some of the others was a book called Unmaking the Presidency by Ben Wittes and Sue Hennessy.
The lawfare folks.
Yes.
Susan Hennessy, she's now at the Justice Department.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Formerly. Yeah. Ben Wittes is still
lawfare, at. Yeah.
But the book was Hennessy and Wittes and what I really appreciated about that book was how I feel like we all became people from the bar and Cheers, norms, right? Norms was everything, right? During the Trump presidency, the debate over norms was the big thing. You know, he's eviscerating norms, he's undercutting norms, you know, turns out we're about norms, not laws.
Yeah.
And they kind of walked through all the norms of presidential behavior that Trump was eviscerating. And they showed you where those norms came from. And they showed you what the consequences were of those norms being lost. And it was very methodical. It was very rigorous. It was not sexy.
Yeah.
But it was useful.
Yeah.
It's the kind of book that helps you interpret all the other books, right? And it came out, for instance, I think it may have been the same week, certainly the same month, as a book by two of my former colleagues at the Post, Carol Lenig and Phil Rucker, when they wrote A Very Stable Genius, a fantastic insider book about the Trump White House that, you know, sold more copies than God, right?
Yeah.
And yet for me, it was especially useful to read the Rucker Lenig book through the prism of the Hennessy Wittes book.
Right.
You know, and those are the kind of books that, I mean, they're all helpful.
The journalistic accounts, the Hennessy Wittes book helps you understand the context you need to know to understand all the transgressive behavior
and why it matters, right? Sort of the impact of it, you know, more than just holy shit, did he really do that?
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. And so those books do, I mean, they're trying to accomplish different things. I'm not saying one is better than the other, right? Like they have completely different missions.
They're worth reading together, though.
You know, but yes, they are worth reading as a, like those two that, which came out at the same time. You know, if I, you know, had the wherewithal to think about it back then, I should have written about them together.
Yeah. There's always several layers deeper you can go. And I had that feeling reading Maggie Haberman's book about Trump, thinking, wow, this is, you know, even though this is one of the best reporters on the Trump beat, this is a high bar. There's just been so much written about him already. And, you know, she cleared the bar because she is a great reporter and found all sorts of new material and put it in a very interesting historical context. What did you get from that book?
Oh, what did I get from Confidence Man?
Yeah.
Like, I liked what, I mean, I'll answer in two ways. You know, one is that I read that book at the same time that I read The Divider by Susan Glasser and Peter Baker and Weapons of Mass Delusion by Robert Draper. And so I read them together and it kind of helped me think about kind of different ways to understand Trump. Yeah. The Haberman book was about, you know, kind of getting inside his head.
Yeah.
You know, what motivates him, what kind of animates him. The Baker Glasser book was about basically Trump versus Washington, right? And I think the way I wrote about it is that it's about while the Haberman book is more about personality, the Baker Glasser book is more about like paper. It's like Trump fighting the Constitution, Trump fighting the Mueller report, Trump getting, you know, the deputy AG to write the memo that could help him fire Comey, like all that, you know, it's about kind of the ritual documentation of Washington and how it like ran up against this guy.
Yeah.
And the Draper book was about the personality, about the people who would come next.
Right. The MAGA movement and its influence.
The Marjorie Taylor Greens, you know, and so those three together helped me understand Trump in a way that, reading any one of them alone wouldn't have.
Yeah.
What I, you know, specifically also really appreciated about the Haberman book, since you asked, it's just the kind of context of, you know, his life in New York, you know, almost kind of seamlessly. It's not like he had like a huge transformation when he became president, you know, sort of like, like the guy who he had become was already that person that he seemed to become in the White House, you know?
Right. That was Maggie's whole thing is like, hey, I watched this up close in New York. Yeah. None of this really surprises me.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is what you would have predicted if you'd seen him for the last 20 years.
But also it's the same thing you would predict if you even read his own books. Like,
It
was so weird. I mean, his own ghostwritten books, you know, but like if you read The Art of the Deal and Surviving at the Top and The Art of the Comeback and like all the Trump memoirs, like, you know,
it's all about faking it.
The rage, the jealousy, the insecurity, the deceit, you know, like it's all there. Even in these books that purport to kind of make him seem like a good guy, you know? And so, you know, that's something that struck me. Like I go back and I look at this piece I wrote in 2015 when he was first, you know, doing well in the polls. And I told my editor, I told Marty Baron, I was like, you know what? I want to read a bunch of the Trump books and see what they say about him. And he was like, that's a great idea. But do it quickly because who knows how long this is going to last.
Yeah,
right.
And at that point, what was the
this is July.
Constellation
this is
of
July,
Trump books out?
This is July 2015.
And those were, when you say the Trump books by him.
Yes. Not the biographies of which they've been very good ones, you know, but just the books that had his, well, by him or that published by him.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
The last line of that review that I wrote in July 2015 was that, you know, this quote of his where he's like, you know, for me, what's more important is the getting, not the having, you know? So like winning the presidency, fighting, like, you know, showing everyone like, see, you know, screw you, I can do this. As opposed to like actually like enjoying governance,
right?
You know,
right.
Like
right.
for him,
right.
it's actually winning, winning that matters. Once he's won, he's about the next thing.
I mean, this was a common line of argument on the right as Trump rose in 2016 that Obama was the celebrity president, so what's the big deal? Trump is doing the same thing. I mean, obviously we've had celebrity presidents before if you think about Reagan, but I always, you know, and I know a lot of people who are very fond of Obama were outraged by that argument because we all know the obvious, there are many differences between Obama and Trump, but you know, there's a germ of truth in that similarity. And you articulate it well in this book without obviously doing a kind of false equivalence between the two of them.
Yeah, no, I mean, because it's not equivalent, right? I mean, you can identify tendencies in people that manifest in radically different ways.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yes.
I think anyone who runs for president, let alone wins the presidency, has a healthy self-regard.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a sense of destiny,
yeah.
You know, about like, you know, whether it's I alone can fix it or, you know, only, in America is my story even possible or, you know, I mean, you can go back and find, I'm sure, similar things for, you know, like George H.W. Bush had the greatest sense of like noblesse oblige,
yes.
You know, that like,
yeah.
That he was born to it.
Yeah.
You know, like it, like, high public service at a high level was a given.
Yeah.
Right.
Some kind of mental disorder is almost a prerequisite.
Your words, not mine.
Brought to you by the Small Business Payments Alliance. According to a new survey, an overwhelming majority of small business owners oppose additional government regulations on the electronic payment system, as called for in the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. Don't let Durbin-Marshall pile new mandates on Main Street small businesses. Learn more at smallbusinesspaymentsalliance.com.
Let's talk about Pence, because there's a nice chapter in here about Pence and his book. And I want to lump in DeSantis.
Mm-hmm.
So we can talk about these two presidential candidates who you wrote about before they ran,
mm-hmm.
and talk about how those campaigns unfolded and ended up for both Pence and DeSantis,
mm-hmm.
and if there are any early warning signs as you look back on their books of
yeah.
You know what, this doesn't shock me.
No, that's a good way of early warning signs. I like that.
Especially with some of your very sharp critiques and insights into their reviews of their books. As I was reading it, I thought, you know what? Yeah, this was exactly the problem with the Pence campaign. He couldn't, you know, straddle this line anymore.
Yeah.
And the same thing with DeSantis. He couldn't he wanted to criticize Trump, but anyway.
They did it in different ways. But in the end, the result was that they weren't actually running against the guy they were running against.
Yeah. And it shows up, right? It shows up in their pre-campaign memoirs.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And so for...
Which is like the worst genre of book, I have to... Yeah. This is the book where people, I'm sure, are the most like, oh, I'm so sorry you had to read those.
Yes. That's the line I always get. Like, oh, you read those books so we don't have to.
Yeah.
If people want to read my columns and reviews and books in lieu of reading all the others, I have no problem with that. I have no concerns. But Pence, for instance, so much of the book is about, I mean, first of all, it's a straight up, you know, autobiography. You know, he talks about his youth, you know, his early years, in college and, you know, and in Congress and the like, when he becomes born again, you know, that's an important part of the book. But obviously a chunk of it centers around January 6th, right? Because his calling card, to an extent, was that, look, you know, when the moments were toughest, I did the right thing. And when the book came out, he was going through a little Pence boomlet moment where he was getting a lot of credit for, you know, for saving the Republic.
Yeah.
And what, you know, I think that the country does owe a debt to Pence for what he did that day. I think that debt would be a little greater if he hadn't sort of allowed so much and enabled so much that led to that day.
Yeah.
Right. You know, one of the things I say in the book is that you shouldn't get credit for saving democracy from the brink if you helped carry it there in the first place. Right. And
yeah.
You look throughout the book and, you know, there are very few moments where you see Pence challenging Trump on any sort of matters of principle. And you see also, even just from the election to January 6th, in that period, there's moments where Pence tells you the reader,
yeah.
that, you know, well, at this stage, you know, I pretty much concluded that the election was over, you know?
Right.
And just want, I was like screaming, like, did you tell the president, you know? Did you call a press conference and tell the public? Like, no, you know?
Yeah.
Instead, he would give these really sort of sneaky speeches to conservative audiences where he would say stuff like, we're not going to stop until like every valid vote is counted and every illegal vote is tossed out. So it sounds like he's suggesting that he agrees with the Trump line about it being rigged, but he's not really saying anything. You know, of course you want valid votes to be counted and non-valid votes to not be counted, right?
No, everyone would agree with that.
And so, you know, it was disappointing to me that he's kind of admitting that like, yeah, I knew well ahead of time. I just didn't say anything.
Yeah.
And one of my absolute favorite moments in that book, is on January 6th, he's describing the event of January 6th, and he quotes Trump's video speech to the rioters telling them to go home, right? And the way he quotes it, there's a little ellipsis in the middle of it, you know, where it sounds like what Trump is saying is very benign, saying like, you know, I know you're upset, you know, I feel your pain, but, you know, we have to have peace, you have to go home, right? But in the middle of there's something that was deleted, right? Yeah. And so
this is when you went to Google.
This is when I just pull up the video and I watched the Trump speech. And what was deleted was a sentence or two where he's saying like, this was a landslide election. Everyone knows it. We won, you know? And so like, it was so remarkable to me that like, when he's looking back on a moment when Pence was like hiding for his life, right? When like, people are calling for his hanging, that he still like covers for Trump.
Yeah.
Right. He's still sort of like massaging the truth to make him look better.
Yeah.
And to me, getting back to your question, sorry, that was a long
tangent. No, this is great.
To me, is that shows you kind of like that unwillingness to actually draw the really meaningful, sharp contrast to speak fully about what went on is part of why his campaign was doomed, right? Like, because if you're just hoping to be like Trump light or something, then why would anyone have new Coke when they can have old Coke? You know, like Trump is still there, right?
Yeah.
And with DeSantis, it was similar. DeSantis had many critiques of the response to the pandemic, you know, that he could have drawn a bright line in the book, distinguishing himself from Trump. But instead, he would only attack Trump by proxy. You know, like he would attack Anthony Fauci, right, as the most evil man in the world. You know, like you know, a dystopian Fauciism of, you know, Fauci-villes that we're living in. And you know, Trump was in charge for the first year of the pandemic, right? Like, you know, like you could, and you know, there's plenty to say about how he dealt with it. And even when the pandemic is his calling card for DeSantis, he was very reluctant to go after Trump. He goes after him in only the most subtle of ways here and there. You know, he will say something like, you know, I'm not so focused on loyalty. I want competence. Or, you know, some officials just want to hang on forever. You know, we have to respect the Constitution. But he would never actually, like January 6th is unmentioned in DeSantis's memoir.
Yeah.
Right. Which is kind of remarkable. So in both those cases, I feel that they never really ran against him. And so you're obviously going to lose, right? And with DeSantis, really only at the very end of his campaign did he start sort of like publicly calling out Trump, but it's not in the book at all.
Yeah. But you're, it's a good argument for reading these books and reading them carefully, because you identified in your criticisms of those books, the defects of those two campaigns. I mean, what you identified there became the core issues that they could never overcome. I do want to talk a little bit about Obama. I've read a lot of these in real time when you published them, but many of them I forgot. And I forgot how critical what's-his-face's biography of Obama was.
David Garrow.
And your channeling of that criticism was a surprising reminder of how tough he was on Obama.
Yeah.
And you seem sympathetic to that. Now, in hindsight, I think some, you know, in hindsight, do you think that review holds up? And just give us your, you know, and maybe instead of me characterizing it, tell us a little bit about what your take was.
Yeah. First of all, I think the context is important. Like, so much of the Obama library of the Obama canon is so like over the top, rapturously praiseworthy.
Well, that's what was why Garrow's was such a relief.
That yes, and so I appreciated that he was willing to, you know, do a pretty hard zag, right, in the other direction, because
and it was by far the most comprehensive account.
Yes,
and I mean more so even than Obama's own memoirs. Yeah, which, as you point out, the first one
was harsh on. I mean, the Obama I mean, I think this is a tangent, but I think that the rule of presidential of memoirs by presidents is that the more removed they are from the author's time in the White House, the better they are. Right.
Absolutely.
Like Jimmy Carter's, you know, he's written like 30 books or so. The you know, one of his worst is his White House memoir, Keeping Faith, right?
Because it's a defense, basically.
You know, one that I read for him that I found utterly captivating is called An Hour Before Daylight, about growing up on his father's farm in Georgia during the Depression. It's exquisitely written, not just like for a politician, it's just beautifully written, period.
Interesting.
You know, and so, but you know, the closer they are to the White House, either in anticipation of or in defense of their time there, the kind of less appealing the books are to me. What Garrow said about Obama is that he sort of was very ambitious from a very early age, kind of knew he had these, what must have seemed like, you know, insanely ambitious, you know, aspirations for his own life, you know, of what he wanted to accomplish. And that he basically organized his life, including his personal life, his personal relationships, around those goals, you know. And one of the big stories that Garrow reveals is about kind of an early girlfriend of Obama's from his years in Chicago, who he sort of felt he couldn't marry because he felt he was... He had gone through an evolution that actually David Marinus writes about beautifully in his biography of Obama, about his own identity, right? About, you know, because Obama had identified, you know, more like with the international students crowd, you know, he was that kind of guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he sort of made a sort of slow but conscious decision to really identify as African-American in the United States, particularly during his time in Chicago. And he felt, according to Garrow, that... to make progress as a black politician in America, he needed to have a black spouse. And so Sheila Yeager, you know, didn't fit.
The ex-girlfriend.
And so, you know, there's a lot of probably like way too much detail of that story, but it was fascinating to me, you know, but it wasn't just sort of like the girlfriend story. You know, there was a lot in that book that I really appreciated. He digs into Obama's time at Harvard Law School, for instance, you know, so deeply and in a way that is utterly fascinating.
Yeah.
And even the book, it's called Rising Star. And it's very much a sort of like sarcastic use of the term, because he accuses the media of, you know, just labeling him a rising star from day one, you know, from when he became the first black editor of the Harvard Law Review, from when he delivered the, you know, the Kerry keynote speech in 2004, you know, rising star is always the term associated with Obama.
Yeah.
And so for me, that book was revelatory, right? Just because of the sheer volume of material that it was able to amass. And also it was willing to be critical of someone who maybe now people are more willing to look back on critically, but for so much of his presidency was regarded in these kind of rapturous terms.
The line that you reminded me of in the Garrow book was, he said he had no core, that he was basically all ambition.
I think is hard to imagine for any human, right? I mean, like we that, think of Obama as a politician because that's the role he played in our lives, right? You know, I think the way I interpreted that line, you know, he like a vessel that was hollow at its core, I think is that.
There you go. You remember it. Yes, that's right.
I only remembered it right now that you prompted me before. You know, is that seemed to override so much else.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that's what I think struck Garrow as just, you know, a biographer and a human.
Yeah.
But I learned so much. Like, I mean, the other thing that struck me from that book about Obama is that, and that has become one of the sometimes when I read a book, that book is more than 1,000 pages long, and sometimes only like 2 or 3 things that over the years just stay with you.
Yeah.
You know? And one thing that stayed with me about Obama that I think I first drew from that book is how he, every step along the way, wherever he was dissatisfied, right? So
he was looking to, and looking
as
to
a
next
state,
thing.
As the next thing, as a state senator, oh, you know, it, no, as a community organizer first, right. You know, like it's hard to really make lasting change. So he goes into politics, right? As a state senator, you can't get much done.
Yeah.
So he runs for Congress, right? He fails, right? Then he runs for the Senate. Oh gosh, in the Senate, like, you know, it's
slow.
This,
it's exactly, old
exactly,
rules,
you know. Yeah. And so then, really and, then an executive. And then even the presidency, he gets to the presidency, and it's like still, you feel like you're so empowered, but you're really so constrained by the institutions. It's like if everywhere you go, you have the same complaint, like maybe it's you. You know, like that's how I, you know, and I didn't really reach that, I think, until I read Garrow, you know, to have that sense of this kind of chronic dissatisfaction that Obama had with kind of every position he was ever in.
It reminds me of a previous guest on this show who talked about the hedonic treadmill, when you never reach happiness because you're always on to the next thing that you think is going to really fulfill you. And, you know, you have to find meaning in other ways. But that's a great synopsis of his biography. What books are you excited about? Political books, Washington books, are you excited about in 2024? What should listeners have on their eye?
So Anthony Fauci has a memoir coming. And
wow, a lot of payback. He's got very long. He's got a long list of people to get back at.
Yeah, I'm interested in that. You know, like someone at the end of the Trump presidency, someone said to me, like, are there any sort of Trump era memoirs that you really want to read?
Yeah.
And I said, the three that I would want to read are one from Robert Mueller, one from Kirstjen Nielsen, who had she was at the center of so many controversial things at DHS. And so I would love to see that from her point of view.
Well, and Nielsen's would be very apropos for this campaign, given how that issue is dominating everything.
So that, like, you know, I don't know if she's working. I think in Mike Scheer and Julie Davis's book about called Border Wars about immigration during the Trump era, immigration policy during the Trump era, I think there's a moment when she jokes. I may be citing the wrong book, but they all bore together after a while.
Yeah.
But at one point she jokes that that if she wrote a memoir, it would be something like, just go ahead and do it, honey. You know, like that would be the title. Because that's what Trump would always say to her, right?
I do remember. Something like that. It was something like that. That was a famous line from one of those books.
Yeah, that he would just say to her, oh, just do it, honey. Just do it. You know, like just close the border. Just do whatever. You know, so, you know, maybe she would call it that. I doubt it. But so I'm excited to read Fauci. I am not excited to read.
Can't wait for this. What is it?
Oh, I'm not excited to read. My colleague Ezra Klein on his in his New York Times podcast recently said this, that there is going to be, you know, the inevitable glut of Biden, Trump 2024 campaign books coming out in 2025.
Yeah.
I don't know who might be writing those. And that what he fears is that what will happen, say that Biden loses, that what will happen is that all those books will have all the text threads and all the emails and all the WhatsApp messages of people saying to each other, you know, now in 2024, like, oh my God, he's going to lose. We have to change horses, but we can't. Yeah. What do we do? You know, and that all that drama will appear in books later on, you know, and that's what happens.
Stayed silent.
That is absolutely what happens. Yeah. And so, you know, that's coming, you know, and of course the stories will be just as compelling, you know, however the election turns out. But there's a certain kind of rhythm and predictability to the, if you think the campaign books by the presidents are kind of repetitive and not that exciting, the like telling the stories of the campaign afterwards, it's very hard to distinguish yourself, you know, enormously in that field. Because A, it's so
competitive.
It's very competitive. So many people, so many talented journalists writing books about that. And they're all like talking to a lot of the same people.
Yeah. Well, and it's unfolding in real time. And, you know, it's, you know, between the Politico and the national newspapers and CNN, there are a lot of great political reporters pulling that stuff out in real time during the campaign. Carlos, the final question, and you're the guinea pig for a new thing I want to do at the end of the show each week in the spirit of trying to broaden the conversation and have a conversation in a podcasty way from guest to guest. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask each week's guest to ask a question for the next week's guests without knowing who that guest is.
I like that very much.
And so I went back to Nancy Mace and asked her for a question because I didn't do it in real time. And Mace, you'll see this question. Maybe in her mind she was thinking, you know, a politician might be the next
chances guest. Are.
It's not like your tax reform plan or anything, but she made it general enough that you could still take this on. And then if you can, you can throw out a question for next week's guests who sure. Neither of us know who that'll be. So Nancy asks you, Carlos, if you can take on one issue single-handedly right now, what would it be and how?
One issue?
One issue.
Like an intractable policy debate?
Well, I'm basically going to say you can interpret this however the hell you want. there are no rules here. But if you can take on one issue single-handedly right now, what would it be and how? And, you know, again, no rules.
If I could single-handedly take on one issue for a day, like what would I solve? So I have all these boring ones going through my head, like, oh, the crisis at the border or the war in Ukraine.
There's no shame in that.
No. But I'm just thinking I'm cycling through issues because issues is one of the most boring words in Washington, right?
That's true.
Issue.
That's true.
It's not like a reality. Yeah. It's an issue. Right.
Crime, so, immigration. Yeah.
I don't mean to be critical of Nancy Mace's question.
Well, this is your job to be critical of what politicians write. So you're playing to your character here.
What would I, you know what? I'll play even more to type. If I could be dictatorial for a day, I would get rid of ghostwriters.
That's
on brand.
It's on brand.
Although I feel like ghostwriters serve all a meaningful function.
And we're talking about speechwriters. We're talking about book ghostwriters.
Not just authors of campaign bios.
Oh, you're putting out a whole little industry.
Half of this town is out of work in this dictatorial republic of mine.
Yeah.
Some loyal listeners
I know are turning the knob right now.
Ghostwriters, speechwriters, yeah. And in a more narrow way, I would get rid of the State of the Union and just have it back to being a written document that they sent. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Biden might be prefer that this year. I don't know.
Yeah.
Thank you. That was excellent. And do you have something off your cuff for the next guest?
Not knowing who this is. Yes, I do. Yeah. I do. I just thought of this now. I recently was speaking to a sort of high level person in the publishing world who told me that if he weren't doing that job, he would be a marine biologist. And not like in a Costanza sense. You know? I've always wanted to pretend to be a marine biologist, you know?
Yeah, George wanted to be an architect, I believe.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Oh, that's right. George wanted to be an architect. Jerry made him be a marine biologist. The sea was angry that day, my friend. He'd actually had a real love for this field as a young man. And if he weren't doing this other thing, like that's what he would be doing. And I was so struck by it. And,
it's sad in a way. It's very poignant.
It is because I kind of feel like he still wishes he had done it. Right.
Yeah.
And so I guess I would ask whoever is coming next, if you weren't doing this Washington thing that you're doing.
Yeah.
What would you do?
This is great. That is a great question. I love it. Thank you for playing along with that and being our guinea pig for that. And both your answer and your new question were great.
Happy to do it.
Thanks for doing this.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And thank you for plugging the book much more effectively than I did.
It's a great book. The Washington book by Carlos Lozada. Thanks, man.
Thanks.
And that's our show. Our producer is Kara Tabor. Our senior producer is Alex Keeney. I'm Ryan Lizza, host and executive producer of Deep Dive. Our music is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Tell us what you think about the show or who you'd like to hear on Deep Dive. You can email me directly at rlizza@politico.com. And please subscribe to Playbook Deep Dive wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.